8 hours into the congressional committee hearing, Curtis Merlin Zale was staring frequently at his watch and fidgeting nervously in his chair. He was not the supremely confident man who had faced Congresswoman Lauren Smith and her committee members earlier. The smug grin on his face was gone, replaced by lips pressed tightly together. Word from Omo Kanai and late-breaking reports of a disaster in New York should have reached the hearing room hours earlier. Congressman William August from Oklahoma was in the midst of questioning Zale when Sandra DeLage approached Zale from behind and laid a paper on the desk. He excused himself before answering August and scanned the paper's contents. Zale was not a man easily shaken by defeat, but at this moment he looked like Napoleon after Waterloo.
"I'm sorry," he murmured to August. "Could you repeat the question?"
Lauren was tired. Late afternoon had become early evening, but she was not about to let Zale leave the committee hearings, not yet. Her aides had kept her informed on the operation to stop the Pacific Trojan. 2 hours later, she was alerted to the mission to stop the Mongol invader. She had heard nothing since 2 o'clock and had fought a nagging fear during the following 4 hours. At that moment, she noticed the faces in the audience suddenly stare behind her. Whispers began circulating throughout the chamber. Then a hand touched her shoulder. She turned and found herself gazing up into the face of Dirk Pitt. He was dressed in dirty jeans and a wrinkled sweatshirt. He looked exhausted.
"Dirk," she whispered, "what are you doing here?"
He didn't look at her as he answered, but stared at Zale and spoke in a voice that carried across the room through her microphone. "We stopped the liquid natural gas tanker from blowing up New York Harbor. The ship now rests on the bottom of the sea. Please inform Mr. Zale that his entire Viper team went down with the ship, and it is now safe for Ms. Sally Morse, the CEO of Yukon Oil, to testify before your committee without fear of reprisal." He abruptly left the chamber as Lauren banged her gavel and adjourned the proceedings until the following day. The gallery went mad. Reporters surged around Zale and rushed after Lauren, but Pitt was waiting at the door and hustled her through the noisy mob, shouting questions and trying to block their path. With his arm around her waist, he managed to steer her through the gauntlet and down the steps of the Capitol to a Numa car waiting at the curb. Giardino stood by the car with the doors open. Curtis Merlin Zale sat at the table, inundated by a sea of journalists and flashing cameras. Finally, he rose unsteadily to his feet and fought his way through the turmoil. With the help of Capitol Police, he made it to the safety of his limousine. His chauffeur drove him to the mansion that housed the Washington headquarters of Cerberus. As he sat behind his desk in his luxurious office and stared out the window into the courtyard below, he weighed his future and found it ominously dark. It was inevitable that he would end up in federal prison. His wealth would surely be taken away by an avalanche of lawsuits. His loyal team of vipers was no more. He rose from behind his desk, walked to a bar, poured himself a shot of expensive aged whiskey, and sipped it as he returned to his desk and opened a side drawer. He picked up what looked like a small antique snuff box. There were 2 pills inside that he had saved in the unlikely event he would be incapacitated from an accident or suffer a debilitating disease. He took a final drink of the whiskey, placed the pills under his tongue, and relaxed in the big leather executive chair. They found Curtis Merlin Zale dead the next morning, his desk clean of papers. There was no final note expressing shame or regret. Giardino pulled the car to a stop in front of the Numa building, and Pitt went directly to Sandecker's office. Sandecker shook his hand vigorously.
"Great job, great job," he said.
Then Rudy Gunn shook Pitt's hand.
"You left us with quite a mess to clean up."
"It could have been worse. We're already working out contracts with salvage companies to remove the ship.
Don't want it to be a menace to navigation, said Gunn. What about the propane?
The tops of the tanks are only 30 feet below the surface, explained Sandecker. The divers shouldn't have a problem hooking up pipes and pumps to other LNG tankers to remove the gas.
It won't be the last time we'll see the likes of Zale, Pitt said morbidly. It's only a matter of time before another sociopath comes along. Next, Pitt went down to the computer floor of Numa and found Jaeger sitting in a small storeroom, staring down at Egan's leather briefcase. He looked up as Pitt entered and pointed to the interior of the open case. Good timing. It should begin filling with oil in another 30 seconds.
You have a timetable? Inquired Pitt.
The fill goes in sequence. Every inflow takes place precisely 14 hours after the last one. Jaeger studied his watch, then began to count down.
Now, he exclaimed. Before Pitt's eyes, the interior of the case began filling with oil, as if poured by an unseen hand.
It has to be some kind of trick.
No trick, said Jaeger, closing the lid. He led the way back to his sophisticated computer system. Max smiled at their arrival.
Max, said Jaeger, tell Dirk about Dr. Egan's leather case.
The case is a quantum teleportation receiver, Max replied.
Pitt stared at Max.
That's not possible. Teleportation is beyond the realm of current physics.
That's what Hiram and I thought when we began our analysis, but it's a fact. The oil that appears in the case is originally placed in a chamber that measures every atom and molecule. The oil is then altered to a quantum state that is reconstructed in the receiving unit down according to the measurements from the sending chamber.